Dear listener, before we start today's episode, I want to tell you about a resource I've created, which I want to share with you for free. I'll tell you what it is and how to get it. If you're not already writing tests for your Rails code, you're probably aware that testing can help you ship your work faster and with fewer defects. Because testing is such an in-demand skill, but since so few developers know how to do it properly, I've created a resource for you called The Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing. This guide is a short, downloadable book which answers the most common Rails testing questions that beginners tend to have, including, which testing framework should I use, RSpec or Minitest? What level of test coverage should I shoot for? What are the different kinds of Rails tests? What are all the Rails testing tools, and how do I use them? My guide covers these questions and several others. To get the Beginner's Guide to Rails Testing, go to railstestingguide.com. Now on to the episode. Riaz Virani, freelance web developer. Riaz, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, do you want to tell us about yourself?
Yeah, so I just moved to Toronto from Atlanta, and there I was a CTO of a company called LoadUp Technologies for about 3 years. And now I do freelance web development, all things Ruby, JavaScript, other things that interest me. And that's what I do.
What moved you to Toronto?
So my wife is Canadian, so that helps. I think, weirdly, I think we knew we weren't going to stay in Atlanta for a super long period of time. We were there for about 5 years. And, sometimes you kind of go through a thing like COVID and it kind of like jars your senses and makes you reevaluate, like, what's the right time frame for this? And Toronto was just like a city we both loved. And so we really wanted to be up here, and it's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Cold, but fantastic.
I've spent a little bit of time in the Atlanta area, and I like it. Obviously, like, the South has really good food. How does the food come? Well, how long have you been in Toronto now?
So it's like 8 or 9 months. Yeah, because we moved last September. So maybe more than that, like 10 months, right?
Okay.
Yeah, quite a bit of time.
Okay. Yeah, so you've had a chance to tell the difference. Like, how does the food compare Atlanta versus Toronto?
Well, so here's the interesting part. So it's like, to me, like, the challenge is, in any sufficiently large city, you're never going to get to try all the restaurants anyways. That being said, the cool thing about Toronto is that, like, it's such a multicultural city. Like, it's sort of like the New York of Canada, like, where people kind of land here first, and they take in a lot of immigrants. So you get, like, you get closer to the authentic thing, right? Like, people who actually lived a lot of their lives overseas and then cook a certain way and bring it here versus people starting a restaurant to, like, start a specific kind of restaurant, right? So I found, an interesting thing I did also find is there's a place across the street from us called Uncle Ray's that has got the best Southern fried chicken I've ever had. So after living in Atlanta for that many years, I was blown away.
That's ironic.
Yeah. And also they have one Chick-fil-A in the whole city. And I put a tweet up the other day, which was like, every time I've walked by there, there's like a line around the block. Because like...
You know, that's crazy. We have like one Chick-fil-A here in Grand Rapids, and frankly, I think Chick-fil-A sucks because, like, okay, they have chicken. Their whole thing is chicken, but you can't even get like a piece of chicken on the bone. You know, it's only like chicken sandwiches.
Oh, yeah.
And
go ahead.
I like to be like a caveman type eater. Like, I like to take a piece of meat with bones in it and just gnaw on it until the whole thing's gone. If your whole thing is chicken and you don't even have that, then like, what are you even doing? But here, the Chick-fil-A here, like, it's crazy. The line is always like super long. They have like, it's super weird. It's like they took this like giant expansive mall parking lot and just like dropped a Chick-fil-A right in the middle of it. And there's a like a fenced off drive-through area. And it's always like super long line of cars So you're just like sitting there in your car for like 25 minutes waiting for your stupid chicken sandwich. I'm like, what are you people doing with your lives?
I find that I feel the same way about whenever I go to a Costco and I see there's like a line of cars about 20 minutes long to get to the pump. And I'm like, there's no way that you're not burning enough gas to get to the pump to justify the discount that you're getting, right? Like, there's a psychological trick here. And so I just flat out can't.
Yeah, that's really funny. Yeah, so Chick-fil-A, I don't get the appeal of it. People love it for some reason. Super popular. Not my thing. Anyway, so like, okay, the food was good in Atlanta, but the food is good in Toronto too. One thing that I experienced, so you and I were talking a little bit pre-show about India and how you were born in India but grew up in the States. I had never particularly cared for Indian food, even though I like all kinds of food. But I never knew if it was because I didn't like Indian food or because I had never had actual good Indian food.
Mm.
And then I went to India, and the food, of course, was way different and way better than anything I had had here. And it was like, okay, no, it turns out I do, in fact, like Indian food. I just hadn't had any good Indian food there. What has your experience been in Atlanta versus Toronto in terms of like the Indian food available?
I didn't find a difference between the cities, but I have generally found that if you think about Indian food, the stuff you get at a restaurant tends to be really heavy. Often it's very North Indian influence because India has a lot of regional cuisine. But it's like, okay, so if you think of like, what does the average American eat at home, right? Be like, oh, American food, burgers and fries. But like, most Americans aren't eating that exact meal every single time, right? Like if you went overseas and had an American restaurant, it would just be this heavy sort of like, you know, burgers, fries, like fried chicken wings, whatever. And so it's similar with Indian food, where if you go to India, like the stuff they're eating every day is not the kind of crazy stuff you get at a restaurant, right? It's much more sort of day to day. It's a little bit healthier because you can't eat that stuff all the time. So I think that's kind of the part that seems really unique. I think this happens with a lot of cultures, like Mexican food, right? The average Mexican restaurant is super, super heavy, but that's probably not what a average person in Mexico is eating every single day of the week. So I wish like someone would just make restaurants that are like, here's the stuff that you like from this cuisine that like exists and is what they actually eat, but is not necessarily what most restaurants serve. That would probably be like a $1 billion idea.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And I've thought about that before myself. Because like, well, first of all, it's like, what is Indian food? Well, what's American food? Like America's huge and India's huge. There's like so many regional cuisines and stuff like that. And you make a really good point that the kind of food people eat in restaurants is not the same thing as people eat at home. And it's like, you're never going to go to an American-themed restaurant and get like tuna casserole or something like that. Like I've never seen that, you know, like stuff that people eat at home. And so that's why like I've always wanted, anytime I might visit some other country in the future, I want to like eat at somebody's house and like eat whatever food they normally eat on a day-to-day basis. Cause obviously it's going to be way different.
Cause if you think of like, okay, like if you go overseas, like when you say American food, they think McDonald's, right? Like I was seeing some article, I think it was like Vice News, where like in Qatar or something like that, like they have American fast food everywhere and they love it. Like in one of these like sort of Middle Eastern countries. But like, if you haven't visited the US, like that is your conception of like that. This is what Americans eat all day long. This is American food and they're just eating fast food. But even inside the US, right? Or in Canada, wherever, like fast food is, there's half the population to be like, I never go eat at McDonald's, right? So it's like, is it really American food if like a huge part of the population is like, I don't even like it myself, right?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Interesting point. So, okay. Let's talk about maybe some computer stuff on this programming podcast.
Yes.
So I was looking at your LinkedIn before the show, and it said that you're a freelance web developer. And it looks like you've been freelancing since like early 2021. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep.
And like, how has that transition gone? Because I've freelanced myself for like 8 years on and off, and I have a full-time job now. But one question that I always ask freelance developers is like, how do you find your clients and all that stuff? So how did that work?
You know, I find that like the answer tends to be two ways. And there was a stint in my career, like 2016, 2017, where I also freelanced. And it was very different kind of work. So like at the time it was, essentially almost like an agency, but you're an agency of one person, where you're out there essentially trying to find people that need software development. Oftentimes you're subcontracting and you're doing this like gig by gig, and your projects are different, you know, every couple months. But what I did this time was a little bit different, because now I've been doing this for like 7 or 8 years, and I've generally had a knack for not screwing people over. So like, if you do a good job and then, you know, people need developers, and the moment you say, well, I'm available and I have X amount of time, and you can kind of scope how much time you want to give people, right? If you have other interests and priorities, like you have the good fortune of like, finding that work. So almost all my current projects are like with people that I either did something back in 2016, or I worked for a company and either they need help, or someone who worked there with me left and went to another company. And so it's not really a huge world for me, but at the same time, like, even if I have that network of 20 to 50 people, right? It's not a massive, massive network. If you have a reputation for doing good work and there's a shortage of software developers, like, you can fill that in. But it's kind of hard to recommend to somebody, because if you don't have that network, it's not like you can magically create it, right? Like, it kind of grows over time. I don't know if that was your experience too, but that's sort of the two stories I've seen from people. Is you're a contractor, but like, you're kind of sort of just like a more flexible employee. For the other side, or you're truly hustling to go find MVPs to work on and find, you know, a specialty project and sort of having to sell yourself a network.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of people, including myself in the past, have had like a really vague idea of what freelancing would be like. And they imagined this like exciting, interesting lifestyle where you are doing all these different projects and you have all these different clients and stuff like that. But for the vast, vast majority of freelance programmers, like you said, you're basically just an employee. You plug into some organization. You go to all their same meetings. Maybe even have like a company email address.
Yeah.
You know, all the other programmers in the team are working on Jira tickets. You're working on Jira tickets. Like, there's no difference in the substance of the work that you work on.
Yeah.
And like, it took me kind of a while to like realize that. And once I realized that, you know, not only for myself, because like, I've done a little bit of a variety of different kinds of freelancing work, but once I realized that like, there is not really this like amazing lifestyle on the other side that I like haven't gotten to yet or something like that. It's like, it's just not there. And a very, very small fraction of people who have tried to build a better lifestyle for themselves as freelancers or consultants or whatever have actually done it. And so I became kind of disillusioned when I learned that. Although it's a useful thing to learn, because it's a recipe for frustration if you're like pursuing this thing that doesn't actually exist in reality. Now, the people who have been successful with that kind of stuff, in my observation, are people who have like a successful, popular book or blog or podcast or something like that. And so they can like, one, get their name out there, and two, that thing that they created gives them credibility so that they can get those, you know, one, they have their name out there so they can attract the clients to them, and then two, the credibility that's lent to them by their book or podcast or whatever gets them actually hired. And so there's some people who, like, they'll do training or whatever, but those people, there's no such thing really as, like, a programmer who like has this way better lifestyle and career. And you have to like shift to doing some other different kind of work. I don't know. What are your thoughts on all that?
Seriously, I think you're 100% right. And I think the people that I've seen that seem to have made that work, they actually have a very niche specialty where they can essentially, so it's sort of like the sort of vector of like what they do is really, really unique. So you can't find anyone else. They've found a way to prove themselves in that sector, and as well as like it's designed so that they can come and do their work and get out, right? And it's not designed where they're doing sort of feature development that's needed support, or they need to support for years on end. So a good example of that, like, and you interviewed him, was Nate Berkopek. Am I saying his name right?
Yep,
who does
yep.
like Rails performance, right? So like he's got this very specific specialty of like companies that use Rails and like want to focus or have performance issues. So he's probably in that lifestyle of being able to like know something really well, go in, work for a few months, and then he might not be engaged, you know, on a consistent basis indefinitely. But you have to want to have that specialty. You have to build sort of a competency, and like people have to know you. And he's written books, he's done podcasts, he's giving conference talks. So, but like, you know, he can't tomorrow kind of take that and be like, oh, you know, I just like I just want to do machine learning now, right? And like, he probably has people that he knows through this business, but it's not going to translate one to one. He's going to have to kind of like start over if he doesn't want to do Rails performance anymore. So I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think there's other considerations though. Like, so here's my thought of it. Like, it's like everyone who is doing kind of the one part of like trading hours for dollars is really doing the same thing, whether you're doing it freelance or you're doing it for a job, right? Sort of like, I'm going to give you, you know, 40 hours this week of my attention and work towards goals that, you know, serve your business, and you're going to give me money, right? And then the other part of it is sort of like, well, I'm going to go build a training. I'm going to build a SaaS service. I'm going to build something that I then have to sell, get people to use, and then it can kind of work on its own. And so like, I think those are the two different lifestyles. Neither of them in particular, like, just means you don't have to work at all, right? Like, the only way you can kind of do the second one and like not work is like make something, sell it for millions of dollars, and then you could choose to be like, ah, I'm going to work 10 hours a week if you want to. And that's the thing, what a lot of people, when they say they have a dream, that's what most people kind of want. But it's much harder to get there, and it's really risky. And you have to have a stomach for essentially not just being a developer, but really being like a business person, entrepreneur, if you want to go there. So for me, what contracting kind of allows, like, that is kind of one of the things I'm trying to do, which is on my spare time, I'm essentially working on a SaaS service with now a friend to potentially, but we know it's going to be a long road, and how do I make that sustainable, right? And I'm not really in tune with this idea of like, we'll just focus on it like 100 hours a week and just hope that it works out 6 months later. So freelance works well for me because it gives me the flexibility, right? And it kind of gives the other side sort of the agreed upon flexibility that, hey, you may not be here a year from now, right? Like with an employee, you're kind of like, if they come and go in 6 months, like not really kosher, right? Like you're not really doing the right thing because they invested a lot of time in you. But that's sort of clear up front as a contract where it's like, well, here's how much commitment I'm willing to give you. And it's really a communication mechanism.
Yeah. And let me tell you, one of the best things I ever did as a freelancer, I at one point started doing this. At the beginning of a client engagement, I would time bound the engagement. So I would say, let's do a 3 month engagement period or a 6 month engagement period to start with. At the end of that period, we can re up for another 6 months or whatever we want to do, but let's limit it to a specific amount of time. That way, if you need or want to move on at the end of that period, there's no discomfort, or there's much less discomfort. Yeah. Whereas if there's no expectation on either end, then you have to have a kind of uncomfortable conversation at some point where you decide to move on, and it's kind of unexpected and stuff like that. That was one of the absolute best things I ever did.
No, I 100% agree. I find that a lot of people don't do that, which is really surprising to me, that like, I thought everyone kind of operated that way of like, here's what I think. I think a lot of times in contract, people kind of take, as developers, they take the lessons of like sometimes shady business deals, right? Where they kind of come in and it's like, well, let me not exactly, like, let me leave some of this amorphous so that it's to my advantage, right? Or exactly, like, what am I committing to? How much time? What are the rates? What are the contingencies, right? Like, what happens if something doesn't work out? But, like, all that's just a recipe of disaster. Another example is, like, whenever I would do contracts and we would do stuff that was, like, from scratch for a customer, like, so many contractors and freelancers would be like, well, I'm going to build a thing, and then when it's kind of ready to in presentation mode, I'm going to essentially do a demo to the client, right? And that just omits so much of the information that they get about like learning about what's easy, what's hard, how software works, like when something breaks to not get angry. They don't see that it's like a very imperfect process behind the scenes. So we would do, no, like you get access to our Jira board, right? Like this is back in 2016, 2017 when I was doing this kind of work. And it's like, we're going to give you, like, you have access to like what's basically like, we'll do a CI kind of process for master. So you get to see with progress every day. We'll send you like an email every day of like, what you can play with now, like almost as if you were within our team. Because what happens then is like over time, they will suggest adjustments along the way, which is great because you don't finish it and then need an adjustment. And two, like they kind of get the feel of how like software is built in this imperfect way and keeps getting iterated on to become perfect. So they become much more bought in and trusting of you because you kind of are like, you know, open in terms of what you're doing and not doing. But like so many, I don't know, just I had a lot of experienced freelancers that are like very cagey about pricing, about showing what they're doing, about sort of like, it's sort of meant to be like, you toss something over the fence to me, I go away in my hole, work for some weeks, and then just show up at the end of the demo, right?
Freelancing or just a regular job, like if you're working on something for more than 1 week, in isolation before you're showing it to some stakeholder, then like good luck getting that to go well, you know, because it's basically a guarantee that when you show the thing to the stakeholder, it's going to be imperfect, to put it lightly. Like best case scenario, it'll have some imperfections that need to be tweaked. Most common case scenario, at least in my experience, is there was some like fundamental misunderstanding or miscommunication about what was needed. And so there's a huge amount of rework that's going to need to be done. And there's a large amount of mutual frustration, and it's just a recipe for bad feelings. So what you do is great, where you're sharing everything along the way. The way that I like to think of it is like the stakeholder is a collaborator, and they're actually helping to design everything as you go. And that way, you know, when it comes like demo time or whatever, you can still do a demo for like theatrical purposes or whatever, or just to like mark the milestone and make everybody feel good and stuff like that, which I think is great. But if you're working together every day along the way, there's no room for surprise, and there's going to be so much less frustration.
I mean, so there, you have limitations there where if you're doing the kind of freelancing where you're almost like an addition to an existing team, then you kind of have to play by their rules, right? But if you're doing kind of, hey, I found a client, they're not really technical, and they're hiring me to build something from scratch, there, it's often going to be that there's a person working with you directly, kind of, and then they have stakeholders inside their company, right, that they're reporting to. And so think of it as like a two-tiered system. Like the person who is your like direct contact with the company, like getting them as closely involved to minimize any sort of dissonance and sort of thoughts between you and them, right? Like that's great. Like show them everything. But then whenever they're going to have to periodically present, like, hey, like I'm working with this contractor and here's what we did, right? Like that's where you probably want to polish it up. And so like not treating all your stakeholders the same way and realizing like also what their needs are, because if they're reporting to some manager, he doesn't have time to be involved with everything. Like he's just going to be like, oh great, like you've got the system up and I can see you can log in and do whatever. But the person who's probably your closest subject matter expert, like who's going to be your direct contact, it's going to be really dangerous if you can't have a working and trusting relationship with them. This happens even within companies, right? This, it happens in any sort of like software engineering relationship where there's either that, oh, if I bring them into the process, they're going to make a bunch of changes, they're going to distract me, blah, blah. And I don't find that's true. Like I find that's an output more of like if you have bad patterns in terms of meetings where you're just meeting all the time for no reason, right? Versus like the fact that you're allowing them to be really involved in the process.
I'll offer a slightly different perspective. You know, maybe that will in fact turn out to be the case that if you allow a stakeholder to be involved, then they'll change all kinds of stuff and stuff like that. But the question I would ask that person is like, why is that bad? Is that bad because the agreement that you made with your client is for a specific pre-agreed outcome? Because I'll also say this, there are some schools of thought around like doing fixed bid projects or even value-based pricing for custom software development, and I really think that that is just a mistaken approach, because the nature of software doesn't really allow you to say, we're going to build X and it's going to take us a month, and then you take a month and build X. Because everything is just so unpredictable and it's a feedback loop. You build the first part and the first part informs the second part, which informs the third part, and so on. And so if the success of your project depends on not having somebody making changes along the way, then that's probably an unhealthy approach that's being taken to that project.
So here's something that I did that I found really helpful. I'm even doing on a project today. So what I would do is, okay, so we have initial meetings about like what we're going to do, how it's going to work. And this is where it's not, I'm just helping add, you know, a horsepower to the team. I'm actually building a project. And I'm supposed to finish it. We'll say, okay, well, looking at this, I know for me, software is really imperfect. I don't know how long it's going to take. But I know for you, from a budgetary perspective, it's impossible for you to be like, you know, blank check, right? Like take however long it takes and spend how much money it needs. So it'll be like, well, I kind of feel like this is going to take, let's just do round numbers for a second, right? $20,000, right? Like I think this is going to cost $20,000, going to take X amount of time. But that being said, it's an imperfect process. So it's going to be 20,000 plus or minus 15%. And as we go, like I'm going to get a much better barometer of like, especially if I'm showing you progress along the way, therefore you're not going to have to make major changes at the end. If you will make changes as we go, but if I think those changes are going to push me outside that boundary, then I'm going to let you know upfront. So it's like, okay, we do 15% of the work. We do like a mini demo and they're like, no, this is all wrong. We need to, you know, fiddle with this. And maybe there's someone on the team who's like constantly fixing CSS or fiddling with little design things take a lot of time. And we do that for like a week or two or whatever. And I feel like, guys, pause. We can do it this way. I think it's going to result in a great product. That this is not going to make it fit within the current budget. But that's not until I've already spent the time and money. It's like early on in the process. They're like, you know, that's not worth it. Let's stay within budget or let's expand it. So there's sort of like, you don't have to make a hard commitment up front. You get to kind of give them whatever predictability they need in terms of a range. And I found at least I have a pretty good sense along the way, right, of like how much progress we're making if I'm demoing iteratively and continuously. So that like it's very rare that we've ended up outside the bounds or ended up outside the bounds without an agreement, being like, well, we need this. And I'm like, well, it's going to take this. If we do it this way, I need more time. Okay, I can get you more money, right? But that was like, you know, several weeks in and not 2 months in. And then we're fighting, right, over like,
right,
you know, you owe me this money and I did its work and they're angry because it went over budget.
Yeah. And a lot of those predictability issues can be addressed by approaching the project in a smart way. And what I mean by that is this. So like when I was younger, I would prioritize not the smartest things at the beginning of a project. Like I remember one particular project I was working on it and I like spent a lot of time on like the styling and visual stuff like first before anything actually worked. And that's like not smart because that's the kind of thing that most of the time you could probably even completely live without. Like what's going to be the worst failure? Like, is it going to be worse if you have something that actually works, but it doesn't look good? Or if you have something that looks pretty good, but it doesn't work at all? Obviously the latter is going to be the bigger failure in most cases. And obviously different projects are different. Like with some projects, the more important thing is to have something in place by a certain date or to not spend more than a certain amount of money. And then some projects, it's more important to very closely meet the need rather than do it on a specific timeline or within a specific budget. Although obviously nobody wants to just take way more time or money than necessary. But it's possible to kind of, especially, you know, if you're working with like a sophisticated, intelligent client, then they can kind of help you understand whether they're going for, whether it's kind of a deadline driven project or a scope driven project. Cause obviously you kind of have to pick one or the other as your fixed aspect of it. And the other one has to vary. And the other thing I'll say is just from an implementation standpoint, it's really good, of course, to get something in production as early as possible.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on a project once where I got hired somewhere. They'd been working on a project for like 6 months and they didn't have anything in production at all. And it turns out the production environment was really hard to set up. And maybe that's why they didn't have anything yet, because it's really hard to set up. But it's like, hey, if this is really hard to set up, then do that in the very beginning when the pressure is the lowest, rather than having to do all that at crunch time, which is exactly what we had to do. And it was terrible. And the project failed. We never, we ended up having to pull the plug and it was actually a really big disaster. So getting something in production ASAP is a huge factor in the overall success of the project.
So you said something really interesting there, which is like, do the hard thing first. And here's what I think happens to a lot of people. They have a new client, they have a new project, they want goodwill. So they'll pick the easiest thing that can create something in a user interface first, which will usually be, let me make you the login screen, add some CSS, like you said, make it visually, you know, aesthetically pretty, and get some of the basic stuff that like I know how to do, I can do it, it's going to be really elegant and fast. But that tends to actually cause the most risk to the overall engagement, because it's usually going to be the thing that you're doing last. It's the integration of multiple pieces together, or interacting with external APIs that are new and unknown, trying capabilities you don't know, deploying. Like the stuff that you're most scared of is the right thing to tackle first, because almost all these cost overruns and miscommunications are going to happen in that messy area. So I'll give you an example. Like that project I was talking about, like it was essentially to grab data from an external API, and then it was from this sort of like enterprise system, put it onto one database so they could analyze their data across, you know, multiple instances of that system. So like, what's the most complex part is like, I don't know this API, like the documentation is in a PDF document, right? Like it's old school enterprise. But like, if I do all my work there, like connecting to it, loading it, looking at the data, understanding how to store it, I'll spend several weeks doing it. And then the result will be no UI, nothing they can see, right? I'll just be like, yeah, I figured that part out, like done. Now I can do the stuff that you can see. But I realized that's where it could go totally wrong. Like that API, that PDF document is out of date, or something doesn't work, or it's crashing and I don't have anyone to reach out to. I could be stuck for months figuring that out, right? So, I had the same decision of like, well, like, can I trust them to be okay and realize I'm doing my job if they can't see anything? Or do I, you know, build login and build all these other kind of basic things I know how to do, but then leave the highest risk part for last? So I would just say like the right answer is almost always like communicate really heavily. Like here's the high risk area. Here's the part I know how to do. I'm going to do this and here's what's going to happen. I'm going to work on it and you are going to be coming back to me week after week and I'm going to show you this thing in a database and you're going to say, great, what's that? And you have to trust me that it's working. Like just say that out loud, that like, it's not going to look like progress to you if I do it this way, but it's going to be me addressing the highest risk part. So kind of to the point of like, bring your closest stakeholders into your decision-making process, communicate what you're thinking, what's going to happen. And you can just tell them, here's what's going to happen and here's what it's going to feel like. And so they're prepared because they're not surprised by the fact that like, hey, this guy's been working on this for a while, but I like, just looks like he's working on back end stuff that I don't understand, right? But if you've communicated that from, hey, this is going to feel like that to you because of these considerations, clients are much more accommodating versus, you know, doing it the other way around that makes them feel fuzzy, but actually causes higher risk.
That's really interesting. I think I agree with most of that. I maybe don't agree with all of it, but I have a couple of comments. One is, another reason why it's risky to like to take your example, build the login screen first and stuff like that to demonstrate a quick turnaround early on, is that gives the client a false sense of the time it takes to do things.
Yeah.
Because if they see that it only took you a day to give them all this stuff, then now, okay, you know, let's say you have features A, B, C, and D. If you get features A, B, C done in the first day, but then feature D is going to take 3 weeks, then that's going to look really bad. It's going to make you look really bad when it takes you so much longer to do that last thing than the first three things. Another comment, and I don't know if this is at odds with what you said or if it's in alignment with what you said, but I am a really big advocate of the idea of a full, what I've heard referred to as a vertical slice of functionality. So like not just, I'm trying to think of an example. Not just maybe like a backend API call, but the API call connected with the form on the front end that drives it. That's good because like, well, for one, it makes it easier to demonstrate progress. And then for two, it's easier to do, okay, let's say if you have a project where you have to do 20 things, it's way better to be all the way done with 10 of those 20 things than to be halfway done with all 20 things at the same time for hopefully obvious reasons. But at the same time, I've seen a lot of people approach their work by saying like, okay, I have to do these four things. I'll get a little bit done on A, a little bit done on B, then I'll come back to A, then I'll move over to C, do a little bit there. And they like nudge all these things forward a little bit at a time. And then they have like all these irons in the fire at the same time, but not a single thing is actually all the way completely done. And so that's also like, if we're talking about like risk factors to not getting a project all the way done or to like having problems with your client, like that's a really big risk.
I think I'm in alignment with you. I guess I don't even think about problems the other way of like doing them in isolation. So I was having to kind of rack my brain. Like to me, the biggest risk factor comes in what's called, I think of it just sort of integration of your code and systems, right? So like if you build a thing to send out, like you configured Action Mailer in Rails, like you configured the underlying stuff, you wrote a bunch of your models in APS, you haven't built the UI, you can't demonstrate, like there actually is a massive risk of you getting into unintended consequences or trouble when you actually try to put it all together. And so even to your point of like deploying to production quickly, like if you're a team and like that's the reason you're not deploying to production is because it's painful and high risk and setting up environments is actually a challenge for your team, do that first. Like literally put up like Rails new and have like nothing in the app, right? And maybe just like a plain user migration or whatever and get it to production, right? Like be honest with yourself about like what's actually going to suck and do that part first. There's also just the psychological element of like people avoid painful problem, right? Like they're like, well, this is gonna be a cluster. Like I know this thing is gonna really be frustrating. I can do that later. You know, like, you know what? It'll be better if they'll just convince themselves it'll be better to do it later. Right.
Yeah. And side note, when, you know, it's an easy temptation. And like when I find myself tempted to put things off like that in order to bring myself back to reality, I try to ask myself, hang on a second, will this be easier later? And the answer is pretty much always, no, it's not going to be easier later. So just do it now.
Yeah. That's another kind of the same concept I think about in meetings all the time, which is like we're trying to decide what tool to integrate with or what approach to use about developing a feature. And like the question is always like people throw in their hats in a brainstorming session. And my point's always like, okay, we should end this meeting where further discussion is not going to give us more actual information about whatever topic you're talking about. And like, if we shouldn't even postpone the meeting, go back and regroup if we don't think additional research is going to help us, right? If it's just we have imperfect information, we have to make a decision and there's nothing we can do to improve that, then we just have to make a call versus, you know, actually it really would help for us to go, you know, think about this and come back with additional wireframes or mockups or whatever.
Yeah. There was this little anecdote that I came across in this Ulysses S. Grant biography where like there was some decision he had to make in some battle or something like that. And it was like this huge decision that like affected like a bunch of money or something like that. And somebody asked him like, hey, like, are you sure that that was like the best decision to make about that thing? And he was like, no, I'm not sure that it was the best thing, but the cost of making the wrong decision about that is way less than the cost of not making any decision about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And would waiting have given him, if there was no cost to waiting, would have even given him more information? And a lot of times what just happens in reality, I think, is like we think we're going to talk, discuss, research, whatever, and we're going to get to a better understanding of it. This happens really often when people evaluate, let's come back to the technical stuff, it's like evaluating, should we use this gem or not? Should we use this kind of approach or not, right? And the answer usually is we can talk about the benefits of trying XYZ approach, but the only answer we'll actually get is like the next thing to learn actual information is give someone a day or two to like spike it and play with it. I know last time we were talking, we had the same exact thing with view components. And I think you had someone on the podcast talking about, right? So it's like, we were really kind of like, this is really interesting. And like GitHub is behind it. And like, it looks really well done, blah, blah. And we talked about it ad nauseum. And then I was like, look, we won't really know what the nuances and edges of this are in our system unless like, us all spending an hour talking about this is wasting a collective engineering day. Let's just give one of the engineers a day to like just make a branch, put it together, like try to replace some of our components with view components, and then tell us what they're actually learning by doing the actual thing. And it's like, would we actually get more information then than us sort of looking at the documentation, thinking about it, and sort of riffing in a meeting about whether we think we should try it or not? And that's often what happens is like just trying it is often much better because engineers like to think they can talk about code. We're actually really bad at talking about concepts, service objects, right? Like you've had stuff about it on this podcast. Like everyone has a different conception of what that even is, right? It's so hard to describe and talk about.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally agree. And there's that kind of corny quote, but it's a useful one. I think you can accomplish more through movement than meditation because actually doing something, like whether it's a spike or just actually doing it for real, it forces you to learn things that you could never discover just by talking about it.
Yeah. And I think kind of goes with, like I had a mantra at the last team when I was CTO that, are we allowed to curse on this podcast? Is that like a thing?
Fuck yeah.
So my mantra was do what works, fuck the rest. And it was very much like, If we thought we read something that was like, oh, we should do this as a best practice, whatever, some famous engineer is behind it, then the answer was that, like, this doesn't matter if they think it's a great idea. Like, we should try it. like spend a day or two playing with it. And if we don't like it, like maybe we're not smart enough to understand whatever fancy pattern it is. That's fine. We're just not going to use it. Like there's no penalty if we find we try something and it just doesn't work for us, despite, you know, whatever everyone else is doing. And so like,
quick side note about that. I think one of the most dangerous things about advice, the most dangerous kind of advice is advice that's genuinely good advice, but it's good advice mm-hmm. for somebody who's not you in your situation, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I just mentioned that.
I think.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, I was saying just like, I know, I totally agree. And I think that was kind of the gist of it was like, you know, someone who's at Facebook or Google or whatever, and is super great at what they do. And, you know, I think a good example of this is like, especially in the DevOps universe, right? Like the amount of time I'm seeing people nowadays, like fiddling with like complex Kubernetes setups. And then, like they don't have a product, they don't have a startup. Now, if you've got like a huge team and like you need that level of sophistication, but they haven't felt any of the pain of needing it, and their first thing when they're starting a startup is to just fiddle with DevOps configurations because that's what everyone's doing. But the answer is like, you know, if you're Kelsey Hightower at Google, right? I think he's still at Google, right? Like he's facing a very different problem set than you are. Like he is not doing anything wrong, right? But like the kinds of challenges they have there and a lot of companies have are not the same kinds of challenges you have. And that's usually, I think, to your point where like the only way for you to know often is like, how can I find a way to actually test this? What I think about it. Like, how can I get actual information? What's the easiest, quickest way for me to get information about whether this is really helping me or not? And then don't stick with it if you find it's not.
Yeah, that's like one of my programming principles is like empiricism is better than reason in most cases. And what I mean by that is like you can sit there and think about stuff all you want. And obviously reasoning is valid and you can use logic to arrive at valid conclusions and stuff like that. But it's no substitute for actually performing experiments and seeing what really happens in the real world.
So I have a question for you, because kind of at the point, this is something I'm kind of curious about different developers, right? I've met developers who say they spend a lot of their time actually just sitting and thinking about like various options. And there's other developers who are like, you know, they just start coding and then they'll be like, then work, rip it out, go. And like, they kind of are more kinetic, right? In their way they reason about things versus some other people like to like, hey, I've got to solve this feature and they'll think for like 2 hours, right? About like all the ways they can approach it. And I just find them very, very kinetic, but I've been very surprised by hearing how different people, you said, how much of your time of your day, if you're coding for say your 8 hour day, is actually your fingers moving on the keyboard. I would love to like have a thing that tracks that and like kind of averages it, see if there's actually like groups of developers or is it on average about the same of like, how often are your fingers actually moving when you say you're programming?
That's a really interesting question. Okay, so let's see how I want to approach that. So I certainly don't like sit and spend more than a few minutes at a time just thinking, even more than a few seconds at a time just thinking, I don't think. But also, I don't just like flail and throw things at the wall and that kind of thing and like try things and revert it and all that. That's obviously an unavoidable part sometimes, but that's not like my workflow or anything like that. I'll try not to give like a way longer answer to this than is warranted, but like there's different kinds of features you could build. Obviously, like if you're building a super standard CRUD interface for something, that takes like very little thought, you know? And so it's like, okay, create the migration, blah, blah, blah. So that's one kind of thing. For something that's like medium difficulty, I'll probably do some thinking and maybe even some like jotting down of like, okay, these are going to be the models involved, at least at a course level, and blah, blah, blah. Here's how I think I want to do this. I might spend some time looking at the areas of the code that I think might need to change. And like spend a little time studying it and say like, okay, I'll have to touch this. I'll have to touch this. Is this change going to be easy to make the way it is? Am I going to need to like refactor this a bunch in order for this change to make sense? Blah, blah, blah. So none of that is like actually just sitting there pondering. It's like I'm either in information gathering mode or planning mode or actual implementation mode. But again, in the early parts, I'll do a little research, do a little planning. And then once I have my plans in place, I'll start building something. And my goal is to get something working as fast as I possibly can. And I approach I approach a small task in the exact same way that I approach a large project. If there's a mysterious part of it, I'll try to do that first. And I have a principle that I call clean the kitchen before you make dinner. So if I have to make a change in some area and that area is messy, or if it's totally tidy, but I just don't understand that area, I'll do whatever I need to, usually like some kind of cleanup, in order to make it easy. It goes back to that, like Kent Beck saying, make the hard change easy, warning, this might be hard, and then make the easy change. And so like, I've only shared like a fraction of the whole process, but I have kind of a methodology that I follow to relatively ensure that I'm never just sitting there stuck or sitting there pondering or something like that. Because like, I consider being in a state of being stuck or just sitting there thinking to be like a failure mode. And so I'm always moving, and like 90% of the time, I believe I'm moving forward. And then, like I said, obviously you're going to have some occasions where you make mistakes, or like you work on something, you discover it's not the right path, you need to back out or something like that. But I think if you have a methodology that allows you to just be moving forward at all times, then that's great. So that's what I try to do.
So this is a bit of a leading question, because I actually did this for like a week one time. Like I used one of those like sort of work timer things that are supposed to track your time. And actually it was like, it wasn't tracking my fingers on keyboard, but I was like trying to pay attention to what I was doing. And so here's what I found about myself. And I wonder if you find it interesting. So I found it was like, there were certain kinds of problems where I was doing 80-20, where I was doing 80% thinking, 20% typing. And then it was flipped the other way roughly when I was doing, and what I kind of identified was like, most of, at least for me, programming is like, I'm either developing a pattern, and usually not at the business logic level. Like I'm talking more at the technical level. So an example might be if I have a Rails app and I have to do a search interface where I have to have pagination and filters and like scopes, so, you know, do all that. And I like don't, I know how to do a search, but like I don't have like the technical patterns underpinning it. So I'm actually sitting there a lot of times thinking of like coming up with the pattern, like how do I do searches, right? Like how does that code look? But then once I do one, right, and I like that pattern, then I have to do the search of another kind of entity. Then it's kind of like I'm taking the same mental pattern and or even code pattern and then applying it in a new way. Or if there's business logic, right, usually it's like, where does my business logic go, right? Like, how do I call it? Like, those are the kind of patterned kind of things. Once I have a pattern, if I need to then apply a new sort of business logic within, it doesn't take me that long usually to write the Ruby to apply the business logic. So I find there's sort of, kind of to your point, there's sort of like pattern development. And so like, you think of when you come into a new team, you're like, how do they do this kind of thing, right? Like, how is their code structured? You know, like what happens when you hit a controller endpoint? Like, what does it look like when they do these kinds of things, forms, buttons, that kind of stuff. And then there's like executing on it, which is like, oh, let me take that pattern and apply it in this new place. And that's usually what we do most of the time. And that's pretty kinetic, right? That's just sort of applying. But yeah, I found that there was definitely weird where it was like, sometimes the day would be like a lot of me, and I would actually get pen and paper to be like, I could do it this way, I could do it that way. But that would just be, especially the initial onset of when I'm coming up with the patterns for that project. So
that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, and to go back to what you said about like the ratio of thinking to typing, I would guess that I only spend like 10% of my time actually typing, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's 50%, who knows, but probably not more than half. But it's like, you can think of that in two different ways. Like one person could conceivably spend 7 hours thinking and then 1 hour of straight typing.
Yeah.
Or another person could spend 7 minutes thinking, 1 minute typing, 7 minutes thinking, 1 minute typing, you know? And so I think that latter way is better because it's a tighter feedback loop.
Yep. And like, while I don't do it, the people that are really big proponents of TDD, that's one of their major reasons for it. It's like, it keeps them in the flow of like, I don't know what to do. Well, I know I can write a test that asserts the behavior I want, right? Like, because at least I should know what I want the system to do, and that I have the next thing to do, and then I just got to make the test pass. And I don't think it's a bad mental model, although I really struggle with TDD. I write tests, but I don't do DDD. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. I do a lot of testing, as I've mentioned on the show, and I, you know, write blog posts about it and stuff like that. I don't do TDD 100% of the time, or even that close to 100% of the time. One of the biggest benefits of TDD of testing in general for me, as I've mentioned before also, is that it allows you to not have to do so much mental juggling, because mm-hmm. you can separate the what you're going to do from how you're going to do it. And if you have to hold mm-hmm. those two things in your brain at the same time, for me, that's a little tough. So if I can take one of those things out of my brain and put it in the code, which is first put the what to do expressed in the form of one or more tests, mm-hmm. then my mental RAM is freed up a little bit, and I don't have to think about quite as much stuff at the same time. To me, that's maybe a bigger benefit than mm-hmm. What was it that you said, like the keeping somebody in the keeping yourself in the flow and stuff like that. I feel like I can have like a mental flow like anyway without the tests. It's just the TDD lowers the amount of horsepower that I need to have as my baseline. So that's what I find helpful.
Yeah, I would concur. And I think as a corollary to that, the other thing I found is that like a lot of the challenges that people have is they write code that's too clever and too sophisticated without meaning to, right? Because they just, you know, where's the right abstraction? What's the right sort of way to do it? And usually code that is much easier to test, I find, is because you had to really clearly isolate your inputs and outputs, because that's, you need to be able to test this code. You know how to kind of trigger it, limit to a thing and test it. And as a result, it's a really good guide to avoid some of this, like code that's really hard to test is probably also going to be really hard to grok whenever you have to debug it, because you can't identify those inputs and outputs clearly. So like, that's why like I'm a really big proponent, not necessarily like if you want a TDD, great, but like, write your tests as you go. Like one of my biggest peeves is when people say, I don't have time to write tests. I've just got like this amount of money to go and I'll write the test later. Right. And it turns out that like, once you get sufficiently down the line, it's really hard to write the test, because if you didn't kind of have that in mind as you were going, it'll have to be code that's really hard to test. And at the same time, I think the challenge is like, you just created this massive burden upon yourself. Like, if you are a small team, that those automated tests, you know, feature or unit or whatever, like they're your QA person, whether you like it or not, kind of doing that stuff for you. And if they're not doing it, you're doing it manually. So,
and I'd even say it's doubly hard to do it later, because if you don't do it later, for one, code that's written without tests tends to be more tightly coupled, and testing requires mm-hmm. your code to be more loosely coupled a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so it's hard because of that, just like you said. But then it's also hard because the motivating factors are often missing. Like it's really hard to justify to stakeholders and to yourself that it's worthwhile to go back and add tests for features that are already there. Because like, I love this rebuttal. It's like, well, does it work? It's like, yes, it works, but that's not exactly the only thing. And what do you mean by works? Because like, one job of the code is to perform its function, but another job of the code is to like perform its function securely in a way that's not going to just like break next time you touch it. And another function is for it to be actually understandable. And I want to comment on another thing that you said, because it's often said that code that's like loosely coupled is easier to understand, which is obviously true, but people don't mention why a lot of the time. And at the risk of stating the obvious, code that's loosely coupled is easier to understand because things that are isolated are easier to understand than things that are interconnected. Because when you have things that are interconnected, then you not only have to understand each thing, but you have to understand the relationships among those things. And so if you imagine like, you know, think of like a polygon with dots at all of its edges or corners or whatever, and then lines between all those dots. Like if you have two dots, there's just one line between them. If you have four dots, there's like four or five, six lines between it, like increases exponentially. And so that's why those things are easier to understand.
No, I'm totally with you. And I gave a talk at RailsConf this year that was about sort of service objects, and the kind of the gist at the end of it was like, hey, we all mean different things by this word, but like the one thing that a lot of people resonated with was that like actually writing that stuff in a functional procedural approach. And mainly because what you said, it's like, it allows you to isolate, like that approach tends to say that each step has inputs, does a thing in the middle, and then outputs that can be chained onto the next step. Because otherwise, if you're kind of like in a lot of object-oriented programming, you have like objects that have superclasses, subclasses, and when you're actually training, like looking through the control flow, it's like jumping through like a hexagon of 7 files that are sort of all intermingled together. And it's really hard to get that right. And so to me, I was like, you know, is there a simpler model that for like 90% of use cases would work? And so to an extent, without getting into all the academics of it, like that part of functional programming is a really good fit for a lot of business logic, because it forces you to say, I can test this piece of logic. I execute it with like these parameters, does a thing in the middle, and I expect these side effects or this output. And you can just stitch them together like Lego blocks and end to end, right? Also called railway based programming. But I've been kind of thinking of like, why do I like this? Why has this, you know, worked on projects? And I think it's exactly what you said. It's sort of like the dependencies are obvious, and therefore that code is easy to test because it is structured explicitly as a flow: input, process, output.
Yeah. And I would even say like dependencies being obvious is obviously good. But dependencies being, I guess the term is just loosely coupled, is good too, because if the dependencies are loosely coupled and the like seams between objects are very distinct, then you can look at one object and understand it by itself, because you can see, okay, this object takes dependencies A, B, and C. Mm-hmm. And I can understand the kind of thing that A, B, and C have to be. But if instead A, B, and C are like deeply intermingled inside that object, then you have to like be familiar with the particulars of the exact versions of A, B, and C that are being passed in. This is tough to talk about because these are all like super abstract examples.
Yeah.
But I think you probably, at least, I don't know if anybody listening knows what I'm talking about, but I think that probably at least makes sense to you, right?
No, that makes sense to me. And it, well, here's actually the part that going into that specifically that I think a lot of people, they haven't found a good solution for. I think it's people miss. I think they haven't found a good solution for is that inside, when you're modeling, like you hit a controller endpoint and you're doing a sequence of steps, right? Like creating a user, I need to like check this. I need to create the database record. I need to send them an email, whatever, right? Like, or creating an order where there's 1,000 steps and discounts and whatever. What ends up happening is you end up with an object and it has like a payment processor instance, and it has like a user validator instance or whatever. And the control flow between those within even the parent object is not obvious, because you get a bunch of instance variables and then a bunch of private methods touching that those instance variables. So then you go down the sequence of some sort of centralized process method, and you have this implicit definition of like, you know, you can't run the payment processor before you've done the validating of the inputs, and you haven't, you know, you can only send the email after you've processed the payment or whatever. And that control flow is actually not super obvious. Like you have to implicitly know that you have to run certain private methods before other private methods. And so, like for example, there's nothing preventing you from calling the, you know, send the email before doing it. It's just not obvious except for the fact that the first person that wrote it put it in that order. And so that's where I think it like, I actually don't think object-oriented programming is bad. Like a friend of mine was like, I was having essentially a academic debate with him, and he was like, no, you're wrong. Like it makes sense in more cases than you think. And he was like, the file object is a good example. Do you really want a separate like file instance that represents the physical file and a separate set of things that represent the functions, like opening it, reading it, like having that in one place makes a lot of sense. I was like, you're totally right. But I think to my opinion now has changed to, I think for a lot of business processes, like you hit a controller endpoint, and when we say what it does out loud, it literally is almost a sequence of steps. And if that is actually the code you're trying to model, like, or the real world process you're trying to model into code, I think sometimes people go down the rabbit hole of trying to make everything object oriented when like the thing you're trying to model is not a thing. It's actually a process. Versus if the thing you're trying to model is a user record, and so then coupling the way to access the name with the thing that represents the data from the record in the table makes a lot of sense, right? Like I'm not arguing it's like active record models. So I think like what's kind of cool now is my thinking has evolved to not one or the other. It's that a good code base has a bit of both, because
well,
you actually want the model.
Yeah. Yeah. So like this also is relative to the discussion of imperative versus declarative.
Yeah. Yep.
And if anybody's not familiar, I think I've even used the example on the show before of like imperative is like, if you want somebody to make you, if you want a robot to make you a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you say, get 2 pieces of bread, get a jar mm-hmm. of jelly, a jar of peanut butter, spread the peanut butter on a piece, spread some jelly on the piece, put them together, put it on a plate and give it to me. Whereas mm-hmm. declarative says a peanut butter and jelly sandwich is this sandwich with 2 pieces of bread and the ingredients are peanut butter and jelly. I would like one, please. Mm-hmm. And this is where things get subjective. I think that declarative is usually easier to understand than imperative. Mm-hmm. And so I prefer declarative when possible. But at the same time, there has to be some imperative stuff because at some point something has to actually happen, you know?
Yeah.
If 100% of your code is declarative, that means nothing has happened. And so there's yep. something that needs to be imperative. And I think it's my current opinion that a lot of developers could probably stand to express more of their code declaratively mm-hmm. than they currently are. Because imperative is a pretty natural way of thinking, and declarative is a less natural way of thinking. Mm-hmm. Although, again, I think declarative is easier to understand. But even that, like, I think probably a lot of developers don't even consciously think about whether they're writing imperative versus yeah. declarative code. And you could probably be benefited, like, even if somebody makes a decision to write more imperative code than declarative, if you're at least making a conscious decision about that, then I can be behind that a lot more than if you're writing it all imperatively without even realizing the distinction.
I agree. And I think the trade-off occurs where if the side effects are really frequent in whatever thing you're trying to model and they are costly and expensive, then when things get messy, declarative will be difficult because just running the machinery over and over, right? You have to control when it's calling that sort of imperative side effect, right? Or just calling that side effect versus a good example might be, and this is a Rails podcast, but I assume a few of your listeners have experience with React, which is sort of the kind of like most popular sort of declarative, like you declare sort of your thing and it just sort of automatically generates and applies to the DOM. And that works really well, except when you have side effects. And that's where everyone who does React, right? If you have to make API calls, like controlling in this sort of declarative cycle when it does and doesn't re-render or call an external API. So if in your backend code, like if running the declarative machinery over and over has no cost, then I think it actually makes a lot of sense. But if you find yourself, like if you're really trying to model a state machine, which actually has to have like state along the way and track things, that's when you might kind of go one way or the other. But like, yeah, I agree. A lot of times it is kind of like inside even the same process or sector of code, you're going to have sections that match each kind of paradigm. And so having a really efficient way to model both approaches is probably better than kind of like forcing your code base to only be one or the other, right? Like just do this, this, and this, or just declare a kind of thing. And I think Rails is really interesting because like Rails has a lot of declare stuff in there, right? Which is like, I don't know, do you think it's be accurate to say, like, you think of the routes file? I mean, it's a DSL. I think, like, DSLs kind of straddle that line where, like, they essentially do create a declarative set of things where you declare a thing and it kind of does a bunch of magic behind the scenes of the DSL.
I would call the routes file declarative for sure because it's a specification. Yeah. There's nothing happening.
Right, correct. Yeah,
it doesn't do anything by itself.
Yeah, yeah. But, like, if you think of the problem it's trying to solve as, like, I need to get information to kind of know how to, like, what controller routes endpoints to create. And if you run it once, right? And that is the routes on boot. You can't change them as you go, right? So a really efficient DSL to do that makes a lot of sense. They're not modeling a business process. They're modeling, like, clear way to define inputs. And then you get the same outputs every time. And it runs through the life cycle until you reboot the app. Or in development, they cycle it. So, like, would probably not be a great idea to force that into an imperative hole, right? It would actually be probably more cluttered and more messy to be like, declare route X, declare route Y. You're implicitly doing that, but the DSL handles a lot of that for you. Because there's no side effects in declaring a route, except for, like, you're not making a database call. You're not, you know, saving a thing, making an API call, something like that. And even then, I don't think just doing that's a bad idea, but if that's what you're really trying to model is like a sequence of steps, then model a sequence of steps, right? Which is more imperative.
Yeah, here's maybe, okay, it can be tough to come up with examples of where declarative is especially fitting, but here's maybe a decent example, parsing a file. So like, you might want to parse, obviously when you parse a file, you're parsing it for some purpose, like to load some data in the database or something like that. Yeah. And of course, the step of loading the data into the database, that's going to be imperative by necessity.
Right.
But there's no reason any of the parsing has to be imperative. That can be 100% declarative. And again, my opinion, because this is a subjective thing, my opinion is that something like parsing a file is probably going to be better and more easily understandable as declarative. So that's maybe a decent example. And just another thought that occurred to me is like, controllers are going to make sense imperative. Views are going to make sense declarative. Models can be kind of a mix, but like for me, I think what I have is like, okay, so my app that I've been working on for the last few years, maybe the active record models are like mostly imperative, but then I have a whole bunch of poros. It's like 1/3 active record models, 2/3 poros in my models folder, and the poros are mostly declarative. But the poros don't really do anything. The poros just give me answers. And so this other stuff that grabs those poros and says, okay, poro A, give me this answer and this answer. Poro B, give me this other answer. And then it composes those and does something with them imperatively. Those are just some random thoughts that occurred to me.
Yeah. We so like in our last code base, we did something similar, but we did just have, like, it was like the models generally were just the sort of active model stuff of like validations, whatever. And we tried to keep the instance methods really lean, but then we would essentially just create these other functions. Like, so we didn't go to the perspective of like a full object where you would give it like stuff on instantiation, right? Because we just thought there's a huge risk then of you making a really complicated poro, right? Where you're trying to model something too sophisticated. So we kind of took the functional approach of like, well, and we used a library called Light Service to kind of help with sort of the organizational structure. But fundamentally, like, you have these actions, which are just functions. They take some inputs, they do a thing, and they get an output. So if you want to say, I've got an order and I want to know whether it's completed, and maybe like that actually requires a bunch of steps. So of like checking different things about the order. So like the old school way would be make an instance method, right? But then you end up with 2,000 line instance of a model class. One approach would be making a poro, you give it an order, and then it knows how to check the things about the order, right, to tell you whether it's completed or not. But like our thing was like, that just has the risk of people adding too many things in there where then they get hard to understand. So what's like the smallest unit we can isolate was like just a function, effectively a function, right? It takes an order, it does what it wants to do, but it's not kind of located inside of anything, and it's kind of located on a module. So like it can't reach across for any instance state at all. Like, it's the only thing it can look at is the parameters it gets, and the only thing we can get out is a Boolean. So there's really, like, if you stretch that to an extreme, it could, I guess, hypothetically call other methods from inside that, but they're obvious. It's not kind of reaching for, like, I don't have to wonder if someone made a really big object. Are they using some other part of the inside of this object? You know, like, are there other things calling private methods or calling private methods or calling some other class? So it was just a forcing function, kind of in a way to make what people really like is to make really small single purpose poros, right? So kind of function that way. And it was like, there'd just be a boundary where you couldn't do it that way. And it was like, nope, that's where we have to reach for the poro, right? Like where we couldn't really make it fit in that hole. So we essentially had our code base ended up looking a lot like, you know, almost a closure code base. Closure is functional, right? I think so.
Yeah. That's my understanding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would be fascinated sometime to like look at some of your code or code with you or watch you code or something like that, because it sounds like there's a whole lot that you and I agree on and some portion that we don't agree on. And to me, those are the most interesting conversations, because like when two people are just like completely not on the same page at all, that's not interesting. When two people agree about absolutely everything, that's not interesting. But when you agree on most stuff and like there's a mutual respect for their opinions of each other that each other has, but then there's some parts that you're like not quite in the same place, that makes for a pretty interesting conversation. Because like some of the stuff that you have said about like composing objects and stuff like that, I sense, but I'm not sure that it's like pretty different from how I would do it. So I'd be curious to see.
I've had this kind of discussion with the people where I think, like, and again, if you've kind of noticed this conversation, I'm not a real absolutist on anything. So like, I tend to be very sort of like, this doesn't fit here. I don't care if it violates what we're doing elsewhere. Like, if it doesn't fit here, let's make a new pattern. But I find from a lot of Rubyists who kind of come from a very traditional sort of like object-oriented program, I share a lot of the principles that they have, and I think you and I do. But then there's just sort of a little bit of a twist at the end of like the implementation looks a little bit different from like a syntax and kind of a flow perspective, how the application flows. And I think that was what, at the talk, what really resonated was I showed a lot of code in that talk, right? I showed kind of like, here's the more traditional way of doing it. Here's like that same exact code, you know, in two or three different ways, not even the ways I like. It was sort of a survey talk of like, here's all the ways you can organize your business function, right?
Oh, interesting. What was that talk called?
It was called Scaling Your Service Objects. But the thing that really resonated was that people could kind of see their own, like what they were doing and like one of the other ones. And then we had a lot of really great discussions about like, well, why don't you try this over here? And a lot of it was, I didn't disagree with it. It was like, I never thought of that. Like, it totally still aligns with the principles. And I learned a ton from the feedback I got at the sort of Q&A from that talk.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, that's the best when you can, like, you go and teach something. And in addition to teaching other people, they teach you something, too. I've learned so much in the course of doing this podcast, my blog posts and all that stuff, just from people giving feedback. And it's like, oh, I've never thought of that. Or, like, it never occurred to me to ask that question and stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why I love doing this, man. Like, it's why, like, I love kind of listening to this podcast and others. And the reason I do it is, like, it's not actually because I agree with everyone on the podcast. Like, because I find as an engineer, I've kind of got to a point where I'm, like, not that concerned or insecure that I'm going to be, you know, shown wrong. It's more just about, like, I want to learn everything I possibly can. Like, at this point now, it's just fun to learn. And I can't do that if everyone agrees with me.
Right. Yeah. There's this quote. I think it might be John Stuart Mill. He said, he who knows only his own side of the argument knows little of that. And that's one that I think about a lot, because like, if you only talk with people who agree with you, and you don't have like a debate with somebody from an opposing position, and a significant part being that other person is not just role-playing, but like they really believe their side of the argument and it's like an actual smart, mm-hmm. sophisticated person, then you're going to learn a lot by that. Even if it's true that the other person is genuinely wrong and you're right, if you never have contact with those people, then you're not going to like be able to articulate even to yourself why your ideas are such good ideas. And absolutely. There's probably going to be a lot of situations where not all your ideas are as great as you think. And in going through that process of debating with somebody who doesn't agree with you, they're going to cut down some of your weaker points and you're going to come away with at least a slightly different position.
So I kind of thought of that as like a really good metric to know, like, do you have a team that works well together? It's like, if you disagree with another developer about something you're working on, they're working on, and you debate it for an hour, right? And it doesn't get like, I hate you, it gets pretty heated. How comfortable do you feel after an hour of like staking kind of your spot in the ground and realizing, actually, I think they're right. How comfortable do you feel being like, you know what, man, I think you're right. I think we should try that. Right. Like, and that's the thing about like, you know, understanding kind of your own ego, like understanding the other person, like understanding the team dynamics. But like, if you can feel comfortable doing that and you're around people that you trust enough to like say, you know what, I've been debating with you about this now, but like, you're making some really good points. I think we should try that next, right? Like, that's going to lead to a tremendous sort of team camaraderie and like help the team a lot. Like, people can have those disagreements because this people have a natural inclination of like, well, I stayed at this position and I can't give in, right? Like, the point isn't to debate. The point is to like help that come to a better conclusion. And oftentimes, like, that means that you initially start on the wrong side. So like, do you feel comfortable saying that to your team? Do they feel comfortable doing that to you? Like, are you too intimidating and too sort of like domineering for other people to be like, no, let's try your idea. Let's see how it goes. Right.
Yeah. Sadly, that's an extraordinarily rare trait for a person to have.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's something I thought a lot about at LoadUp. And I think like I used to always kind of initially when I first started there in 2018 was like kind of the agitator, really passionate. And the other engineers went back around. There was one time where I think it was like Haml versus Erb, right? Was like a debate. For the, you know, Haml is sort of a templating language, an alternative to the standard Erb that comes in Rails, and Haml kind of has more of a DSL and it's sort of like Python-esque with sort of not having come up with closing brackets for your HTML. And like we debated it forever, and we started him, and he was like, I just get super confused by it. Like, he worked more on the front end. He was like, can we just do a thing that looks more like HTML? And then after now, he made one point, like, well, if we hire someone else who's a pure designer, they are going to have a much easier time working in Herb than in Haml because they're familiar with HTML. And I was like, shit, you're right. Like, I just remember saying that out loud, being like, you're absolutely right. Even if I have a small semantic preference, like, yes, if we hire people to work purely on the design side stuff, like, this is going to be a lot of friction. I was like, you know what? Let's do it. Let's switch it over. And everyone was just like, I remember at the time, I think like we went home almost arguing. And then I came back the next week, like, you know what? Forget everything I said. You guys are all right. Let's do it the other way. And I think that helped a lot because it was sort of like, oh wait, I can come up with an idea. And if it is better, like, you know, hierarchy doesn't matter here. Right. Cause I was CTO at the time. And I think having those little proof points are really, really helpful. So,
yeah,
but I would admit it was not easy to do that. It took a lot of like,
oh, it's super hard. And that's one of the reasons it's not common. It like goes against your whole human nature to concede in that way. Okay. So we've gone way over our allotted time, which is completely fine with me. And sometimes I have a guest on and I get really sad when it's time to go because I feel like we could talk for 2 or 3 or 4 more hours. And you're one of those guests. I feel like we could talk for a super long time about a lot of topics. But let's leave it there. And I'll ask you the question that I ask everybody at the end of the episode, which is, where can people go to find more about you online?
Yeah, probably the easiest place to go is, just a personal website I have. It's called riazv.me. So it's riazv.me. I have links there to go to like Twitter and go to like talks I've given and stuff like that. So, and I've been posting a lot more on Dev2 in terms of like technical articles and things. So, but there's a link to that there as well.
All right. Riaz, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yeah. Thanks. This is fun.